This episode of The Compendium is sponsored by Home & Brew, your source for handcrafted and exotic tabletop gaming gear.
Welcome to The Compendium, a resource designed to help you spend less time learning D&D and more time actually playing.
The cacophony of numbers as the DM.
Good Lord, yes.
Everyone's just shouting them out. Like, hold on, people.
Not super well understood by most people, I found in my experience. And you pull the lever, and they go, wrong lever, and they fall down. And
why do we even have that lever?
Why do we even have that lever?
Put your hands up, Yzma.
Hi, welcome to The Compendium. I am Jason, and I am joined by my host, as always, Casey. Casey, say hi.
Hi, everybody.
Say goodnight, Gracie. Okay. Hey, welcome to The Compendium, where we spend time helping you learn the rules of D&D so you don't spend more time learning those rules and you can actually play, or however it is Casey usually says it. And today we're actually going to get into combat, get into the rules of combat, how combat works in D&D, and why it's so important, and why we're going to spend 37 episodes talking about it. So, yeah. So are you excited, Casey?
I am. Combat, I think, is hard because it's one of the biggest parts of the game, and it's also one of the most mathematically heavy and kind of has the most components that you have to remember on how these things work and how they work together and how they layer. So I think this is going to be a really good chance for me to refresh and then learn some more. And I think that's why it's a great place to start for getting into game mechanics, because kind of fundamentally, that's one of the biggest parts of the game, is those kind of combat interactions.
Right. And with D&D, you really are kind of looking at three main kinds of adventure. There is combat, exploration, and social interaction. And in the Dungeon Master's Guide even kind of alludes to that very specifically. And I think combat takes such a precedent and forward role because when it comes to social interaction, that's kind of subjective, right? Yeah, there's rules for deception and insight and persuasion, but it's really, you know, well, what's this person's disposition and how is the dungeon master feeling that day? Did no one bring cookies? You know, and it's really subjective.
Are you hangry?
No, I had a Twix earlier. I'm good. This podcast is not sponsored by Twix. Then there's exploration, and exploration is so custom, right? Because everyone's drawing their maps or they're using little figure, dungeon tiles to do that. And even the traps and things that are in there, those are going to be custom. And so it's different for everybody. But then when it comes to combat, the system gets really, really granular and really specific and math oriented with very predictable and specific outcomes, that it is very ubiquitous and very uniform for a large degree for everyone. And so combat gets focused on a whole lot. And there's some people who just live for combat, mm-hmm. and others who are like, well, yeah, it's just part of the game, but I really love the social interaction. And so like 98% of people are you know, either into or really into combat. So it's not surprising that this would be such a big conversation.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the other key points about combat that kind of gets us into just an overview about what combat is in general is that it's also one of the key ways that people level up their characters, because you can we've talked about this in one of the last episodes, that you can gain experience points in a number of ways, but the primary way that you gain XP is by defeating monsters. And so this, I think, is huge, because it's that stepping stone for people to be able to level their character up to that next level that gives them an extra boost on their spells or some of these other elements.
Yeah, exactly. And while there are chances for you to get XP by, you know, defeating a trap, solving a puzzle, being the go-between two warring factions of merchants or something, XP really, you're right, does come through killing the monsters and winning in battle. So let's get into that. So with D&D, when it comes to battle, it is interesting because it is the one time where you're taking turns and where, to be honest, time slows down. if you think about the Matrix or something, and you see bullet time, which used to be a lot more impressive, but it's still pretty cool, where everything slows down as the hero does this cool thing. That's what's happening in the battle of D&D, in the combat portion of D&D. And so in a battle, everyone's taking turns, the monsters, other members of your party, yourself, and each of the things that you can do in your turn takes 6 seconds. Okay. And so everything is really, really slowed down and drawn out. And so what's interesting to know is that everything that everyone else involved in battle, the monsters, your party, is also taking place in those same 6 seconds. And so if you've ever been around the table and you've seen a single round of combat happen, you know it could take easily 15 to 30 minutes, mm-hmm. depending on people not being prepared and staring at their phones, or the size of the party, or the size of the battle in general. But all of that took 6 seconds, because even though, you know, Kortha is slashing with the sword, and then Carthen's behind him casting a spell, and then the rogue sneaking around, we don't know where he went. All of that happened in 6 seconds, the same 6 seconds. And so the way I kind of think of it is when you are watching like the slow-mo replay from a sports ball game, from like football or something, and you see that this whole play took 6 seconds, but you see that the running back turned and did this, and just after that, a split second after that, the lineman saw him and he pivoted, and just then on the other side of the field, the quarterback threw the football. And so all of this happened really, really quick, but in D&D they're slowing it down, drawing it out, so everyone has a turn and it's not chaos. And even despite that, it often can be kind of chaos.
Yeah, and you and I, Jason, were talking about this before we started recording this episode, that you can get into some really almost philosophical discussions about those 6 seconds. And one of the things that I think fascinated me with our conversation was that idea that since technically everybody's turns are happening in unison, mm-hmm. When people are watching someone else's turn and then making a decision based off of, oh, well, they were able to hit that guy, so that guy took some damage, so I'm going to hit that guy too. Realistically, that's metagaming, because you're not one at a time taking turns and going up and whacking on someone and then going back into line and the next person comes up to, like, you know, see what's happening and be more strategic about your attacks.
Right. Yeah. It's not Final Fantasy. It's not a turn-based JRPG, you know, as much as we like it to be sometimes, but you're right. And there is a bit of metagaming that happens in there, but some people can hand wave it away and say, well, that's just because this is an elite fighting force and they've been together for years and they kind of know how each person kind of does their own thing. But some of the most enjoyable combat experiences I've had as both a player and a dungeon master is seeing the people say, well, you know, I'm going to do what I was going to do because I didn't know you were going to do that. So I'm just going to go ahead and do my thing. And I don't know if my character would have seen you do that. And then they do something that just kind of throws a huge wrinkle into everything, which is always, well, you know, a lot of fun. So yeah, you're absolutely right. And it gets into questions of the fog of war, it gets into questions of how easy it is it to kind of chrono trigger, like, you know, link your attacks together and have synergies and all this stuff in battle. And that's maybe why we don't see more collaborative things happening in battle, right?
Yeah. So let's kind of, we talked about battle happens or combat happens in rounds. Everybody has to take turns within that round. And that is decided. That's not just decided at random. Like everything else in D&D, that is decided with a dice roll, which is how the rest of combat is determined. So when you go into combat, have your D20 and all of your other polyhedral dice at the ready, because that's when you get to use pretty much all of them. So let's talk a little bit about dice rolls and especially some of the lingo, because when I went into it, I remember I came and I watched a game that you were DMing, you invited me to kind of observe, and I was taking notes on my laptop about, like, oh, dirty 20. Okay. Da, da, da. And so let's talk a little bit about, you know, looking back, I'm like, oh, that was, how did I not know that? But, you know, let's go into a little bit about dice rolls, what they are, how you use them, and then some of those that lingo that you might hear at different tables.
Absolutely. And I would love for you to pull out those notes sometime and look back and see that. That'd be hilarious. Man, okay, yeah, those were good times. Yeah, I let you be a fly on the wall in a game, and I think my players were like, wait, why is she here? I'm like, oh, she's just going to watch, observe. She's a psychologist. No. not your mother. Yeah, okay. So so one of the most common phrases you're going to hear is nat 20. Okay, so a nat 20 is a natural 20, which means on your 20-sided die, or D20, you've rolled a 20, which is the highest number on there. You have a one. You have a 1 in 20 chance, a 5% chance of getting that. And the reason that that's so important, that it gets its own name, is that in combat, on an attack roll, and an attack roll only, a natural 20 is a guaranteed success. So if you're swinging your sword or firing your bow or shooting a ball of fire at someone, and on the attack roll you roll 20, it doesn't matter what kind of negatives or positives modifiers you put onto that, it's a success. Right. And oftentimes something called a critical hit, which is means that then you're going to take whatever damage dice that attack was going to normally do and double the amount of dice and then add the bonus a single time at the end. So mm-hmm. if you have a sword that does 1d10, you'll then roll 2d10 and then add any relevant modifiers. But what's really crazy is that when you're a rogue or a paladin and you have like smite or sneak attack and you're rolling 2d6, 3d6, it suddenly becomes 4d6 or 6d6 and you just wreck the whole table, you know, so it's kind of crazy. And then there's the less impressive version of a natural 20 called either a modified 20, which is what I've always used to say, and then a dirty 20, and which is a phrase that Joe Manganiello I think coined or at least made popular, dirty 20, which means the roll of the die plus the modifiers made it a 20, but it's different than a natural 20 because it's not a guaranteed success, because yes, there are some many monsters in the monster manual that a 20 non-naturally doesn't hit. And so you kind of have to make that distinction.
Yeah, and that'll come up too, like at your table. A lot of times for me, a player will be like, oh, I got a 20. I'll be like, is it a natural 20 or is it a dirty 20? Because that makes a difference. Like,
yes.
You know, that is like night and day difference. And so that's usually where I'll clarify, or I'll ask them to clarify, just so that there's no confusion about what type of benefit that they're going to get from that roll.
Right. Because it goes to the difference between you hurt a creature to you obliterate and eviscerate right. a creature. and changes the game drastically. And then on the other side of things, you have a natural 1 or a nat 1 or a natural failure.
Where those are my favorite.
Yeah, those are
as a DM. As a DM, those are my favorite. Clarification.
Yeah, that's an important clarification for sure. So a natural one, like you'd expect, means you rolled a 1. And now on an attack roll where you get a natural 1, it doesn't matter what you add to it. It will always fail. You missed. You can't do anything to fix it except for something like lucky or something like that, where you can re-roll the die. And now what I want to say is that two things about that. In older versions of the game, there were tables that you could roll on, charts, that when you got a natural 1 or a critical failure is what it's called, then you could look on that chart and see what bad thing happened to you. Like you trip and fall, or you cut your leg off. That was the really old dark days. Or you throw your sword 20 feet and have to go retrieve it. Like you just, it's like a Laurel and Hardy sketch or Three Stooges, you know, it's just really, really bad. Some people call it a critical fumble as well. And you can absolutely do that. Just be consistent, because it works for the monsters too. I typically don't do the fumble rolls, the kind of the extremely critical failures, because it's just, there's enough going on that I don't need to worry about that and track that. So that's a natural one.
I have a friend who has a really genius method for natural ones that I adopt from time to time, which depending on the circumstances, when a player rolls a natural one for their attack roll, depending on the circumstances, I might have them roll a d20 a second time and then determine based off of that number how badly they fail.
Yes.
So if they roll a, you know, a 19 or a 20, I'll be like, yeah, you know, you just miss. But if they roll like a 2 or a 3, they might even end up doing damage to another player.
Yeah.
So
I like that.
That's a really fun way to do it, is that you're still leaving it to, you know, the dice gods to decide for you. But it's a fun way to be like, let's see how badly you fail.
Exactly. Or what you could do too is just say, you know, if you're swinging a sword, in particular a melee weapon, and there's another friendly party member next to them or really close to them, and they could say, okay, other person, make a dexterity saving throw. And if they fail that, then their flubbed hit hits them instead. You know, I've seen that happen as well. And that's a lot of fun. So, yeah. And then there's another thing that can greatly affect the success or failure rate of your roles, which is advantage and disadvantage. Mm-hmm. And this is a newer element for D&D. I think I think it originated in 5th edition. Because I don't remember hearing about it before that, but now it's so ingrained, I can't imagine not using it, because it's just so wonderful. And so what that basically means is if you have advantage on a D20 roll, and it doesn't have to be just attacks, it can be literally anything, then you're going to roll the D20 twice or two D20s, and you take the higher of the two. So it's not a numeric bonus, it's just a best one out of two kind of thing, which is kind of fun. It gives you a really kind of balanced out advantage. And then disadvantage is the same thing, except you take the lower of the two. And so it's still possible you could roll really high on both of the die and still make success. It's just going to edge against doing that. And there's a lot of things that can cause you to have that. There are certain spells that can give people advantage on attack rolls. There are certain racial feats that give people like advantage on, you know, poison saves or saves against sleep, this kind of thing. And so it's one of my favorite tools, especially as a DM, because if someone tries something really outside the box, something really kind of wild, and you're like, how do I adjudicate this? How do I kind of like judge what should happen here? Using advantage or disadvantage is a really quick, balanced, easy way to represent and to recognize the person's crazy choice, but to also not let it just kind of break the game from a rule standpoint. And so it's a great tool that you can always kind of pull out and use.
Yeah, I like how you said crazy choice instead of like creative or great choice, because one of the ways, for example, that I've used disadvantage recently is I have a character that when there is alcohol about tends to consume. And so I would make him make constitution rolls to see how drunk he was. And I was waiting till he met a certain number, and then I'd say, all right, it wore off, but he was never meeting that number. And so at every combat, I'm like, dude, you're seeing triple of these people. There's no way that you'd get a clean swing in. So you're at disadvantage for every combat roll until you can get your constitution good. And so that's, you know, like it doesn't even necessarily have to be like a rule mechanic or something else. It can be a story mechanic or a character mechanic even. It's just a lot of fun. And it, like you said, it's a great way to switch things up a little bit without anybody being in control of that fate.
Exactly. And I love your mechanic there with the character who likes to consume, because the and we'll talk about this later, but the condition poisoned does that. And I'm just like, yeah, he has alcohol poisoning. He's just really messed up. So by the way, I'm going to propose that we change the name of our podcast to, we'll talk about that later.
I think we should take that into consideration. That's our catchphrase.
It is. We'll talk about that later. The compendium. And you can buy those t-shirts now in our store. No, you can't. All right. So
that's where you get the business cards. And it's like, do you want to know how to play D&D? And you flip it over and it's like, we'll talk about that later. Oh gosh.
Oh man, that's awesome. Please keep that in the episode. All right. So let's talk about initiative. So we have talked about some of the basic terms and ideas around combat when it comes to D&D, but now it's actually started. The adventure has begun, and initiative is basically the way that you help to create order and process into those 6 seconds, those stretched out 6 seconds of a combat round where everyone gets a turn. And so initiative basically is just a way of tracking who goes first and in what order. And initiative, surprisingly, is not a separate stat or skill. It's interesting because if you look at the character sheet, you'll see like your AC, your hit points, your initiative bonus, your proficiency bonus. It would make you think that erroneously that initiative is its own thing. Initiative is actually just a dexterity ability roll. Okay, so if you have a dexterity of 18, that means you have a plus 4. So you're just going to roll a d20 and add 4. Now, there's some things that can affect just your initiative, some feats and other things, but that's all that it is. And so it's really a dexterity-based ability check that tells you who goes in what order. An interesting side note is there is a feature of the Bard, unsurprisingly, called Jack of All Trades, which says that if you make an ability check and you don't already have proficiency applied to that check, you can add half your proficiency to it. So that means bards get to add half of their proficiency to their initiative roll as well.
Yeah, because it's just like it's based off of a ability.
Right, and it doesn't get a skill. Yeah, it's like its own skill. So they always get to do that. And if you use a tool like D&D Beyond, it'll actually apply that correctly, which is kind of fun. So yeah, that was kind of buck wild. So initiative. The DM will say, roll for initiative. And you know, it's about to go down. And some people will groan, some people will cheer, but everyone pulls out their D20, they roll, and then they start telling the numbers.
The cacophony of numbers as the DM.
Good Lord, yes.
Everyone's just shouting them out. Like, hold on, people.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that Matthew Mercer from Critical Role, unsurprisingly, has a great way of doing that. And I do something very similar. What I say is 20 and above, and usually one, maybe two people or none will say me. And they'll tell me the number and I'll write it down. And then I'll just go 15 and above. And everyone chimes in 10 and above, 5 and above. And then if someone still hasn't said anything, I'm like, all right, man, what'd you get? They're all, we got a 2. I'm like, yep. And there's the paladin, folks. All right, awesome. So, and I like doing it that way because you're getting it in chunks. It goes way faster than, like you said, the cacophony. And I like to say, you know, 10 or above, because I'll always have that one player who goes, oh, I got a 16. They didn't hear me. And I'm like, okay, good to know. So they didn't miss it and I have to go back. So I catch them pretty quick if they're not paying attention. So you lay those out. And then when it comes to the monsters, you roll for them as well. And
the DM. By the DM you does. Mean the DM.
Right. I'm so used to being always the DM. Sorry. So
the forever DM trademark. Exactly.
Yeah, that's the only reason I play on Twitch is so I can be a player. So the DM will roll for the monsters, and they're on the monster stat sheet. It'll tell you what their initiative, dexterity bonus is. Occasionally, they'll also have an initiative score. Some more martially based things will have that, but typically, you're just going to add the dex bonus like everyone else does. What's nice is that if you have just tons and tons of bad guys, you can roll one initiative for every type of bad guy. So if you have 4 hobgoblins, 3 goblins, and an orc, you're going to roll just 3 times. Once mm-hmm. for all the hobgoblins, once for all the goblins, and once for all the orcs. Now, there's multiple ways of doing initiative for monsters, but that's the recommended way in the Dungeon Master's Guide. And that makes it go really, really easy. That way you're like, and now the monsters go, and you can just keep, you know, goblins as one spot in your kind of initiative order as you've written it down or on little cards or whatever you want to use. But then there's always the question of what happens in a tie, right? Have you ever had that happen to you?
Who has not had that happen to them?
Exactly. Now, in the book, in the Dungeon Master's Guide, it says the DM chooses, or the players can decide between themselves.
I thought, and I might have made this up, I thought I heard that it was the person with the higher modifier, but that's not officially in the DM handbook?
Correct. That is an easy way of deciding it so that people don't fight, because some tables, there's people who are like really are jonesing to be first. It's like, you know, drivers in your city, you know, like road rage and stuff. But what the book actually says is... that if a tie occurs, the DM decides the order among DM-controlled creatures, and the players decide the order among their tie creatures. The DM can also decide the order if the tie is between a monster and a player character. So one of the easiest things that you can do to help kind of mitigate any fighting or whatever is like what you said, and I've done this as well, is who has the higher dexterity? And one person will go 10, another person goes 17, And they're like, all right, you go first. And so now you just fixed it. They're just moving very, very almost, you know, in tandem in that way. But for the purposes of keeping things on track and in order, you got to know which one's which.
Yeah, I have actually gotten to the point where I had two players tie their rolls and then their dex modifiers were exactly the same. And so they just rolled off. I had each of them roll again. And then the higher of those two rolls was the one that went first. It got very deep into it for something relatively basic, but you know, just make it work. If you're not sure exactly what to do or how to resolve that issue, just make it up and, you know, keep the game moving along. Nobody wants to stop the game because people can't decide who gets to go first.
Yeah. Which is one of the main rules to remember as a DM. Keep everything moving. Just don't let stuff stop. If you don't know, make it up and refer back to secret rule zero of being a dungeon master. You're always right. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, usually, I mean, there's no right way or wrong way to track combat initiative. You're going to see something different at everybody's table. For a good while, I just had pieces of paper that I folded in half and I would just tent them over the top of my DM screen.
Yep.
Currently, I'm getting a new DM screen made that's going to have like an actual like kind of notch out of the center of it so I can set cards into it with those different names. I've seen clothespinned ones where there's a rod and people use clothespins with numbers or characters or monsters on them. So really, however it makes sense to the DM, usually it's done visibly to everybody. So that's not one of those things typically that only the DM sees, just because people need to be able to prepare for what they're going to do. So having that visual to the entire party, I think, is really beneficial.
Yeah, exactly. Like you said, so much of what the Dungeon Master does is behind the screen. This is one of the things that doesn't have to be. And so what I will say is there's a couple of things that you can do to make your life easier when it comes to tracking initiative. Like what you said, you like pieces of paper. I make little horseshoes out of Legos that are different colors, and I lay them on top of my Dungeon Master screen so they can slide, almost like an abacus.
Mm.
And so I'll move the colored kind of little horseshoe I've made, little loop, off from the left to the right on my side of the screen, and then keep moving it over bit by bit until I'm done at the bottom, and now I can start over and push them all over. The other thing to do is, especially while someone's deciding what to do, they're like, okay, so he's going to, that's when you can look at the next person initiative and go, hey, Caleb, you're next, be thinking. And they're like, oh, okay, yeah. And that really helps some people. And it helps remind you what's gonna happen next too, and keep things flowing. The other thing that you can do, especially if you have someone else at the table who's ever been a DM before, or you suspect might be a great dungeon master, but they need a little confidence, have them track initiative for you. Give them a piece of paper and a pen or a dry erase or something and say, hey, write this down. And they'll write it down. And then they'll be the ones calling out, hey, here's who's next, here's who's next, here's who's next. It's okay to have an assistant in that way to help someone else take care of something so mundane as who has the next number in the order. And that can kind of free your brain and your hands and your words up to do the things that everyone else wants you to do.
Yeah. I will say a little DM tip that I found has worked really well for me with like the paper tent cards is I'll write the character's name on the front, and on the back of it, which is the side only I can see, I'll put that character's AC, hit points, vulnerabilities, or resistances, so that when I'm rolling, you know, for a monster or something and I know who they're attacking, I can just glance up and see, oh, their AC is this, they missed. So I don't have to be like, they did this, was that a hit, was it not? So it's kind of a nice little way to have a cheat sheet for myself with some of those numbers too. So you can use it to your advantage depending on how you get your setup.
Yeah, absolutely. Whatever you can do to make things run smoother and not get stopped, all for it, absolutely. So let's talk about what you can do now that it's your turn, right? There are two of the most common things that you can do on your turn, which is your action and your move. Okay, so your action is like the main big thing you're going to do. This most commonly is stuff like swing your sword, cast a spell, that kind of stuff. If you look at most spells, it'll say casting time, one action. So that's your one action you get. There's very few things in the game that will give you more actions. Spells usually are magic items, but you get one action. And then you get your move, where you can move your distance up to your speed. And so if you look at your character sheet, you've got at the very top there typically is your speed, which will say like 30 or 25 or 20, or if you're a monk, it'll say like 80. And that's how many feet you can move in your 6 seconds, along with everything else that you can do, like taking mm-hmm. your action. And then there's something called a bonus action. A bonus action may or may not exist. It's like an electron. You can know where it is or how fast it's going, but not both, and unless you have a Heisenberg compensator. Never mind. Anyway, so if you have a feature that gives you something to do with a bonus action, then you can use it in a bonus action. So it's like this briefest of moments is so quick. And there's some spells that have a casting time of bonus action. Or if you'll read in like the fighter description, it says that as a bonus action, you can take a second wind or you get some health back. So if you have a feature or a spell or something that lets you do something as a bonus action, then on your turn during that round, you have a bonus action to spend.
Now, can I ask, with the action and the bonus action, does one always have to come before the other? I mean, I assume bonus, it means you've done one, so you get an extra one. But can you do a bonus action first and then do like move or do something else and then follow up with your action? Or does it always have to go action, bonus action?
No. So with all three of these main kinds of actions you can take during your turn, your move, your action, your bonus action, for the most part, there is no set order that they have to happen. Now, there are some triggers to a bonus action that say if you attack with a melee weapon that's light and you're holding another melee weapon that's light, then you may also, as a bonus action, make an attack. So some bonus actions have prescripted triggers like that. And then you do have an order implied. But for the most part, it doesn't matter. You could cast a spell like Hunter's Mark as a bonus action, move 20 feet, attack with your bow as your action. You're like, oh, I still have 10 feet of movement left, and then move back 10 feet. So you can mix and match for the most part in any order that you want.
Okay. And then the last action that's not really an action, but I want to throw in there is free actions. I don't know if there's actually a term for them, but those things that maybe don't fall into either category. And for my group, a lot of times this will look like, can I just like shout out to him, we mean you no harm?
Yeah, exactly.
Like certain things where I'm just like, okay, sure, I will give that to you for a free action. I'm not going to make you take your 6 seconds to yell this out. I feel like you could yell that out while you're moving or something else is happening. So there are, is that technically a thing or is that just like a universally accepted
idea? So, yeah, typically things that are inconsequential or are not going to really change the course of combat, like yelling at someone, watch out, you know, or to taunt them or something, is a free action. And I don't think free actions are really even listed in the player's handbook or the Dungeon Master's Guide. Typically, those little things are seen as things that are included in another action, right? So one of the examples that they give in the book is that you can communicate however you want through utterances, gestures, as you take your turn, you know? So if, you know, you're going to use your, a wand or something, and you also want to do a little flourish and like flip it and catch it and something, like that's just part of the action of doing it. So there are free actions kind of hidden in there, but typically if it's going to be free, it's not going to count as anything mechanically wise in combat. Now, you said there was only one more thing.
With actions.
Well, there is a reaction action.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Right. So I know. Now,
fair enough.
What Casey, you're probably thinking is it's not an action because it doesn't happen on your turn.
Mm-hmm.
Or typically doesn't happen on your turn. So it's not something that you can just pick, because reactions almost exclusively, I think, are something that happen on someone else's turn and they have a trigger. Okay.
Right.
The most common reaction is an opportunity attack. And so in this chaotic tumult of all these people doing all these things in 6 seconds, if someone tries to move away from you in combat and they're not being careful, everyone's kind of looking for a chance to get in a cheap shot. And so if someone moves away from your threatened area, your reach basically, which is typically 5 feet, you can spend your reaction, and you only get one of them, to make a melee attack and hit them with an attack. And then they can, after that's resolved, they can continue to move away unless something prevents them. But that's it. That's your one reaction to do that. There are some spells that are reaction, like the spell Shield. When someone attacks you and it succeeds, you can cast Shield as a reaction to bump up your AC, which maybe might make it a failure, and you'll take no damage. Mm-hmm. And so a reaction is always going to interrupt what was ever happening once the trigger has been activated. And so you have the option to do that, but you only get one reaction per round. So after everyone's gone, and now it's your turn again in that round, now you have a reaction again that you can spend to do other things like that. So those are your basic four: your action, your bonus action, your move, and your reaction.
One thing that's action related that is getting minorly into the weeds, but that I want to talk about is the act of readying an action. Yes. I have a lot of players that do that, and it's kind of like, I don't want to attack yet. Do I have to swing at something? And so basically that idea of, you know, well, I don't really want to pull out the big guns yet. And a lot of times it happens from, you know, they go into combat, but they're wondering if maybe they can resolve this peacefully. They don't want to swing first. They're going to wait to see if the monster attacks them before they go in guns blazing. And so, you know, can we talk a little bit about what some of those other mechanics look like outside of, you know, your regular actions that you're still able to take within the mechanics of combat?
Right. So ready action is not super well understood by most people, I've found in my experience. I get a lot of questions about it. In fact, I even got it wrong on Instagram on a story, a Q&A I was doing last week. And I had to delete it after so many people were like, I don't think that's right. And I was like, I looked it up. I was like, you're right. I'm wrong. Let me delete this and try again. And I apologize when I did it. So basically, there is no mechanism built into D&D as of right now that lets you change your order in the initiative. Okay. And part of the reason for doing that is to minimize the chaos. And also, why even roll for initiative in turn order if you're just going to change it later? I think that may be a little harsh, but that's the logic behind it.
Sure.
So one of the actions that you can take with your action, one of the moves basically, is you could ready an action. And so what you're doing is you're basically saying, I'm going to set up my own if-then statement, my own conditional statement. Mm-hmm. And you're going to do that with your reaction. So it's another way that you can use your reaction. So you can say, okay, I'm going, and all it does is let you take a reaction when the trigger happens, typically an attack or pull a lever or shove somebody or something like that. Okay. So the downside to this is that it doesn't include your bonus or your move at all. So the way that you want to use a readied action is simply this, is you want to move in position, do anything with the bonus if you have it, and then say, okay, if this guy stands on the trap door during this round, I'm going to pull the lever. Okay, so I've set up an if-then statement. And for, as your reaction, and someone steps there, you go, I'd use my ready action, and you pull the lever, and they go, wrong lever, and they fall down. Why do we even have that lever? Put your hands up, Yzma. All right, now, so that's how that works. So it's a little restrictive, but it allows you to do something that's triggered, plan ahead a little bit, and do some things you couldn't normally do. One of the other downsides is that you can actually let go of that before the if-then statement comes to pass. So if someone walks past you and you're like, oh no, they're going to get the squishy wizard boy behind me, I better do something, and you choose to take a opportunity attack with that reaction, you've lost your reaction now and you can't pull the lever anymore, but maybe you killed that guy as he passed by. Yeah, and also you can choose to ignore the trigger, because then maybe both your party's fighter and the bad guy are standing now on the trap door, and you don't want to pull the trigger. So you don't have to, but you set up a scenario that has a particular outcome should you choose to do it. So that's how readied actions work.
Okay. And then there's some other things in there too, but I think they might, I don't know if they fall into a different category or not. Things like hiding, help actions, disengage. Do right. those fall into the same umbrella, or are those technically a little bit different?
So with your action, which you get one of, there's a number of things you can use with as an action. The most obvious and common is you can attack, okay? And if you have something like the extra attack feature, like barbarians and fighters do, they can attack multiple times with their one action, okay? Now, another thing people can do is they could cast a spell. We talked about that. Now, there's some other ones that get increasingly lesser known or lesser used that you can use with an action. One of them is dash. Basically, you're saying, for my action, I'm going to choose to dash, which basically lets you move again. So you could move with your move action, and then you could take the dash action with your action and move again. Mm-hmm. So you could, but now you're out of things to do. You can't, you know, attack or anything unless you have something else clever that you want to do. So that's a great way to like chase someone down or get to a spot on the battlefield that you really critically need to be there right now. And there are some classes, by the way, like Rogue, that can do some of these as a bonus action instead, which is kind of fun. So Rogues at a certain level as a bonus action can take the dash action or the disengage action, which we'll talk about in a minute. So that's that. So now disengage, as promised, what that is that as an action, you can take the disengage action, and you moving away from an enemy doesn't provoke opportunity attacks for the rest of the turn. So what you could do there is you could realize, oh, this isn't going to go well at all. I need to get away from this guy. He's 10 feet tall and has four arms. What was I thinking? And so you could take the disengage as your action and then do your move action and move away. And you're being careful and cautious as you do that, so you can get away without getting slammed one more time when you have really low hit points. Another thing that you can do is dodge. Dodge is really cool because what it is instead of you attacking with your action, you're playing defensively. And so you are bobbing and weaving out of the way so that attacks against you are at disadvantage, right? And so you're choosing not to engage. It's almost like fighting like a Shaolin master or something, you know, where like you can't get a hit on them. And so that's what you're doing. So until the start of your next turn, any attack roll made against you has disadvantage as long as you can see the attacker. So if someone's hidden or invisible or behind you, maybe not so much, but this is a great way to kind of get through a particularly bad battle, especially if you realize that whatever you could have done attack-wise just isn't going to cut it. So mm-hmm. maybe staying alive is your best option there. And then you can take the help action. The help action is interesting because what it does is it lets you help someone else out with a completion of a task. So basically, when you take it, you pick one person to help, and they gain an advantage on the next ability check or attack roll that they have against something. Okay, so this is one of the few things that actually you can do outside of combat as well, where you're not really counting actions. So outside mm-hmm. of combat, you could say, well, our rogue is trying to bluff his way into the king's quarters. I want to help DM. And they go, great, how do you help? Well, I'll tell him that I'm this man's doctor, and yes, his foot is broken, and he has desperate news from the front lines and needs to see the king right away. So you're choosing to help this one guy. And now he's going to roll his deception check with advantage. He's going to roll 2d20 and take the higher result. Now, in combat, typically it's going to be a help making an attack roll. And so this is you kind of trying to distract a creature or something, or a feint, or you dodge out of the way just as the barbarian swings his axe over your head to smack the guy. And so he's going to get advantage on his attack roll. And typically you have to do it within 5 feet of the person that you want to help. But once you've done it, you don't have to stay there. So you could rush in, ooga booga booga, and distract the monster, then run out, and they still have advantage on their next attack.
Okay.
So you don't have to stay there, but you do have to be within 5 feet in order to use it. Of course, as always, there are some exceptions to that rule with spells and class features and the like. And then, because this is a long list, so there's like three more. So there's the hide action as well. This is like when we're doing all the skills, right? So the hide action basically is something you can take with your action, where you can make a stealth check and attempt to hide and not be seen by foes or opponents, right? So you can be like, this is Korthog, he cannot be seen. And so this lets you be able maybe to attack from a hidden position. So now the dodge action doesn't work as well. Or if you're a rogue or something, now they don't know you're there. So maybe now you can get sneak attack, that kind of thing. And some characters are better than others with that. Rangers, rogues, and halflings are typically pretty good at hiding because of special class features. But again, this is what you're doing with your action, not your move. So it's you foregoing combat typically or doing damage to do this to set up something for later.
Right. And sometimes, I mean, this should go kind of without saying, but sometimes that doesn't always work out because like dodge, you could say, well, I'm going to dodge when somebody tries to hit me, but nobody tries to hit you that turn. So you're not guaranteed that that action, it's kind of premeditated a little bit, but you don't know what other people are going to do. So you're welcome to do it. But if it's not triggered, or if you don't get attacked or some of these things, you just kind of lost out on your turn by, you know, trying to make that strategic call.
Right, exactly. It's the better safe than sorry mentality, which, you know, if you that or dying, you take that.
Yeah.
You also can take the search action, which usually is pretty ill-advised in the middle of combat, but you could do it. You're basically going to say, while everyone's fighting, on my turn for my action, I'm going to search, and I'm going to try to find the secret switch that opens up the gate so we can get past these guys, or the pressure plate and reset it so that this chamber doesn't fill with water. You know, so there's some good reasons to do it. And so basically, it's letting you make like a perception or investigation check to do that. Now, I will say that I know some people who have skill checks in their combat scenarios, and they run them differently. This one is particularly for trying to find something. You're searching, right? You're doing investigation or perception. If someone wants to try a different kind of skill, like say Arcana, and I don't think that it's going to change the course of battle, but maybe identify that these guys are like the red-robed wizards of Thay or something, then I'll let them do that as a bonus action or a free action. If I think it's like, well, that could be good information for them to have. It's not really going to change the battle much, but go ahead, you can do that. So, but this one specifically is a kind of action that you can take. And then the last one is use an object. This goes back to what we were saying before, that if you find a lever that you want to pull, or you want to pull out a wand and start summoning something like that, using an object that's not an attack, then you can do that by taking the use object action as well.
And that wouldn't, I mean, you just kind of clarified this, but the first thing I thought when you said use object was back to our episode about weapons, how we were talking about improvised weapons with like, you can grab the leg of a chair to bash somebody with. That is not this.
No, no. So I really pulling a lever or unlocking a lock, shutting a door and barring it. Those would be good options for that. But on a magical item, if it's a non-combat thing, like a lot of magic items will say, as an action, you can use this orb to talk to someone from a distance, infinite distance, as long as you're familiar with the person, that kind of thing. That would be, well, I'm going to use my action to activate my you know, scrying orb, you know, so those kinds of things. I don't see that one happen too much, but I think it happens without being called out as to what it really truly is a lot. And so they have it in here just so that it's covered when you do that.
Thanks for tuning in and listening with us this week. This episode of The Compendium was actually sponsored by Home & Brew, which is a small business that handcrafts exotic wood tabletop gaming accessories like dice trays, dice vaults, and DM screens. They actually let you customize your own dice trays, and when you do that, you get the option to pick from one of 13 different types of exotic woods and two different colors of suede lining. You can personalize them by including engravings on either the side walls or on the rolling surface. So they make awesome gifts if you have any nerdy D&D friends in your life, or if you're just wanting to up your personal D&D game at home. You can visit them online by visiting homeandbrew.com to order a customized dice tray. If you're interested in their dice vault or DM screens, go ahead and actually contact them directly through Instagram. We hope that you guys enjoyed listening in this week. If you haven't already, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast and leave us a review. Jason and I really enjoy creating this content, and it definitely helps boost our charisma modifier every time we see a 5-star rating pop up. The Compendium is also on Patreon, so if you like listening, that is a great way to contribute to the content that we create. New episodes are available every Tuesday and Friday, or if you're a patron, you get them a day early, so Mondays and Thursdays. And you can always keep up with us between episodes by following us on social media. We're on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Just look us up by searching for The Compendium. Thanks for tuning in, and we will see you next time.